My name's Rainn Wilson, and I played Dwight Kurt Schrute.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Office Deep Dive. I am your host, Brian Baumgartner. Today, you will be listening to my conversation with Rainn Wilson. Now, when we started shooting the show, Rainn, he was the only person that I knew. I met Rainn back in circa 1999. All right, I was living in Minneapolis, and I went to see a production at the Guthrie Theater in Minneapolis. Now, you should know this. The Guthrie is a very, very big deal. It is the largest regional theater in the country. It puts on incredible shows, world-renowned, et cetera, et cetera. Well, Rainn was starring in a production of Philadelphia, Here I Come. And I went to the show, and I have said this many times. Rainn's performance in that show, it was the greatest performance that I ever saw on the Guthrie stage. It was brilliant. And so the show was over, and I was like, I've got to meet this guy, Rainn. This guy is brilliant. And so we got introduced, we met, and we became friends. And when I showed up to work on the first day of the office, there was Rainn. And I could not have been more delighted to see him. He is, he's a special one. That's for sure. I am so excited for you to hear this interview. You are going to hear Rainn in a way you have never heard him before. I love talking to him. You are going to love listening to him. So, without further ado, here is Rainn Wilson.
Bubble and squeak, I love it. Bubble and squeak, I know. Bubble and squeak, I cook it every morning, left over from the night before.
Oh, there he is.
Hi, buddy.
Hey, man. How are you?
I'm good.
Oh, how are you? Good to see you.
Good to see you.
Yeah, yeah.
Are you wet?
That felt really inappropriate.
Why?
We have some salty nuts for you.
I saw just a giant, like 5 pounds of salty nuts.
We understand that was requested.
What?
Salty nuts.
Nothing is requested. Wait, what does that mean?
I don't know.
All right, let's do this.
Let's do it. Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm all yours for 2 hours.
Really?
So exciting.
Are you excited?
No.
Why not? It's fun to see me.
I'm excited to see you.
Yes.
That's what I would put it.
That's where you're at?
That's where I would be at.
Yeah?
Yeah.
We're going to talk about a lot of interesting things.
I also am excited about talking about The Office in terms of like some stuff that you don't normally hear, you know, like the longer, more detailed stories of some of the intricacies of how stuff was arrived at and some of the choices that were made along the way and stuff like
that. Well, that's what my goal is with you because you're a thoughtful person.
Hmm.
I'm going to try to do that.
You're not going to get that from Creed.
No, I know. Well, I think we've scheduled him for 22 minutes.
Okay.
So that's fine.
I'm excited to talk to you.
What?
So we're starting. We're rolling.
Yeah, we're just chatting.
Good.
What were you doing before The Office?
Before The Office, well, going way, way back before. So I did theater for about 10 years in New York before I did any TV or film. So really was a theater actor. A lot of people ask like, oh, were you in improv or were you in stand up or something like that, but I didn't do anything. I'm similar to you.
No, exactly.
Yeah, theater person that kind of found that we were well suited to kind of comic character guys.
Right.
Despite our ravishingly good looks. So, I came out to LA in 99 and then started doing commercial auditions and voiceover auditions and little guest spots on TV shows. I was on like Charmed and—
You were?
Yeah, and CSI and—
I did CSI.
You did CSI too?
Yes.
Were you—
I was a furry, a guy who gets sexual gratification out of wearing a big furry suit.
I was creepy guy in supermarket. I'm not kidding. Creepy guy in supermarket.
I think I was dog. I think literally
that's
that
perfect.
Was, I think that was my role.
That was perfect. Yeah, so I did a lot of that stuff and some pilots, and I did some decent movie roles here and there. And what happened for me that really led to The Office is a lot of people think I kind of waltzed into to Dwight, but the big role that put me on the map was in 6 Feet Under. So after a lot of slogging around the casting people, Libby Goldstein, they brought me in multiple times to 6 Feet Under. And finally, I got the role of Arthur. And I did ended up doing 13 episodes on that right when HBO was heating up and that was kind of revolutionizing what we think of as television. You know, Sopranos, The Wire were on at the same time. It was Entourage and a lot of really amazing shows, including 6 Feet Under. And all of a sudden, I popped onto people's radar. It was really incredible how that happened, because that was one of those shows that everyone in LA watches. There's sort of the shows that people watch all across the country. They'll watch NCIS LA or something like that, and it's 50 million people will watch it, but no one in LA who are like tastemakers watch it. So this 6 Feet Under was one of those kind of shows, and that's what put me on the map. And all of a sudden, I was in kind of pretty high demand for movies and stuff.
I know you won a SAG Award for that.
The Ensemble, Ensemble SAG Award, yeah. I might be the only person who has been part of winning an Ensemble SAG Award for both drama and comedy, because I did it for 6 Feet Under, and then twice we won. I think twice. We won for The Office.
And now, so you're in high demand.
Yeah.
And were you aware of the British version of The Office?
I was. So my friend Sam Catlin, he had heard about it, and he had seen a couple episodes and somehow gotten some, like, British DVD or something like that, and had, like, even, like, an English DVD player or something. Somehow had advanced copies and was like, you've got to see it. Groundbreaking, amazing. And so we went over, like, on a special occasion, like, you've got to watch The Office. And we were blown away. So I was really, truly one of the first people to see it in the United States. It might have been one of the first couple thousand people to see it in the United States. And just, we loved it. And then he would get his hands on a couple more episodes and we'd go back and have dinner and watch like two or three more episodes. So I loved it. And what happened was I got cast in a pilot with Janine Garofalo for ABC. Mark Maron was in it and Bob Odenkirk was in it.
Okay.
And this was this infamous pilot that we did the table read and they pulled the plug after the table read. So they had sets built. Wow. We had locations. We had a cast. We had plane tickets. We were flying out the next day, literally the next morning after the table read, start shooting. And did the table read. It went terribly. But guess what? I still got paid.
And that was the same pilot season as The Office?
Kind of. The Office didn't really follow a pilot season when it was first casting.
Right.
So what happened was Vernon Sanders, who's one of the
executives at NBC.
Executives, right. And I ran into him in the parking lot on the way to this infamous table read. And he's like, hey, we got good news. And I was like, what's that? He's like, we got the rights to make the American version of The Office. And I was like, outside, I was like, oh, great. And inside, I was like, motherfucker. God damn it. That fucking sucks. Because I loved the British Office so much. I didn't have an idea of like even what the American Office would be or what role I would play or anything like that. But I was just like inside, I was just kicking myself. Oh. And then the plug gets pulled on that. And then I call my people. And I'm like, hey, I hear about this office. And they're like, yeah, well, there's a few months to go on that. So fortunately that the space was opened and the door was open. The universe works in mysterious ways, Brian.
That's right. It does. And so you eventually get a call to go in and meet, correct?
I was the first audition for The Office. I have in my office at home framed the audition sheet of Allison Jones the first day of the auditions for The Office. And I was number one on that list. So other people on the list are Jenna Fischer. You can find it. It's on my Instagram somewhere. It might even be in my book, in the photos included in my book, so you guys can find it. But I think Adam Scott auditioned. I think there were there was a lot of great talent that auditioned.
My story about that, I'll share with you really quick, was when Steve left. Allison Jones came to me. He had a little party, a little reception. She came and she goes, I was looking for stuff for Steve that I thought might be cool. She probably gave that to you, like when she was searching around.
Uh-huh.
And she hands me a sheet and it says, Kevin. And it says, Brian Baumgartner, Eric Stone Street, and Jorge Garcia.
No kidding.
So that was like the final three. But
oh, fantastic. Yeah. Wow. Wow.
So you...
And although Eric Stone Street is way richer than you.
He is now. I know.
Yeah, he... Sorry.
Shoot.
Sorry. So, yeah. So on that first audition, I auditioned for both Michael and Dwight. And my Michael was just terrible. It was just simply a Ricky Gervais impersonation. And I knew that I had more of an affinity for the Dwight role. And I knew that I could really deliver on that. I just felt it in my bones. I'm like, oh, this is me. This is exactly my kind of weird.
Yeah. Well, you were so different also than Gareth in the British version.
Yeah.
I mean, he was much
Mackenzie
more
Crook,
Weasley and Dwight. Way more authoritarian and trying to derive power, whereas Gareth seemed more backstabby.
Yeah, we're different in a lot of ways and similar in a lot of ways. And it was this incredible luxury to go, okay, here's Mackenzie Crook, brilliant actor, really strange looking dude. And he killed as Gareth and was so interesting. And I get to steal all of his best stuff. And then there's maybe stuff that I can add that's more my own. So it's win-win all around. So one of the things that Dwight is most known for is saying absolutely ludicrous, preposterous stuff with a total straight face and a deadpan without any knowledge that what he's saying is ridiculous. And really, Mackenzie did that so beautifully. And I really just, frankly, stole that from him. Another thing I stole from him was the haircut. I read an interview with him where he said he went to like just a local barber shop out in like Slough or some, you know, suburb of London. And he kind of got the haircut that would be the least flattering for his head and the most ridiculous haircut. And I read that. I was like, oh, I want to do that. So I spent time in the mirror figuring out what's the haircut that is going to make me look the most ridiculous. I have a huge forehead. And I was like, I'm going to frame my forehead perfectly with these little draperies of hair that will highlight the enormity of my carapace. Is that a word? I think it is a word.
I think it's a word.
These guys aren't even listening.
No.
And then like really short on the sides and then and intense. And then it evolved over time. But
interesting. Now, so we're not going to talk too much more about the audition process. But at what point did you meet John and Jenna and Steve? In the callback sessions?
Yeah. So the callback sessions were months later, mostly for those listeners who don't know, the way pilot season used to work, at least it is less and less so, but all the scripts would start getting released in December, January, and all the auditions were, this is called pilot season, January, February, they'd shoot in like March, early April, decisions would be made in late April or May about staffing up for the summer and if something was going to be on the air in September. So it was always a very narrow kind of window. It's like this is how this 9-month window worked. So the office was outside of those bounds a little bit. I think my first audition was like in September or October, and then the callback was like December, and then we shot in like February or something like that. So I had to wait months after that first audition, and they had a callback situation where they brought everyone and their mother in, anyone they were considering for the role, over a weekend. And Greg was incredibly thorough. And I spent, I spent 7 or 8 hours on the first day there. And I met Jenna, I met John. Steve was shooting some other stuff, but he had a little bit of time. And we improvised together and did a couple scenes together. We were given scene, oh, here, try this scene. Not much time to prepare, stuff we'd never seen. And just like, just shoot it, you know? And then we'd improvise, you know, like Jim brings Dwight a glass of water and it's like, just improvise Jim bringing you a glass of water. And Dwight is immediately distrustful, like, has he poisoned it or something like that? And that was not really my gig. I didn't do, you know, Upright Citizens Brigade or Groundlings. I wasn't really an improv guy, but I'm good at improvising kind of in character. In fact, later after I was cast, Greg came to me and we had a coffee and he gave me kind of a little bit of a warning talk. And it kind of scared me. Essentially, he said in a very diplomatic way, you improvise better than you act when you're on the script. And I was like, what? He's like, yeah, it's more natural. It's more, when you're doing scripted stuff, it feels a little heavy and a little forced. And I was like, oh. And this was before we were going to shoot the pilot. So I begged my manager. I was like, I want to see the audition tapes. I want to see my audition tapes. And sure enough, he was right. Because somehow when I improvised, it was just a little looser. It was a little more off the cuff. It was a little weirder. When I was doing scripted stuff, I don't want to say it sounded like a theater actor or something like that, but it sounded a little more scripted. It didn't have that kind of documentary feel that The Office had to have. And it was a really great learning experience. Like, oh, I need to just kind of let the script go, improvise around the script, let it be much lighter.
That is fascinating. I did not know that story.
But it kept me up at night. I was like, oh shit, what does that mean? I'm a good improviser and a terrible, terrible regular actor.
So I want to talk about you creating the character of Dwight, how you went about that.
Yeah.
Like what elements you chose that you brought into Dwight.
Yeah.
How did you approach that?
So I always say that in terms of like when people ask me about playing Dwight, I always say that I think my goal was to make Dwight very specific, you know, having, you know, Dwight have a pager, stand a certain way, like drive a certain way, sit in his chair a certain way, have certain attitudes about certain things that are very specified. Because no one had done like combination muscle car nerd.
Right.
You know, when you think about it, there's a lot of disparate elements that go into the creation of Dwight. Like heavy metal muscle car rarely equals Battlestar Galactica fan. And I do think this is true as an actor. And the more specific you make your character, it made him more human and then more relatable. So muscle car, nerddom, heavy metal, you know, Amish. Of course, Greg Daniels always said that the beet farmer thing was his grandparents, I think, were literally beet farmers in Poland. And they grew beets, I think, like before the Holocaust. And so he put that in from that.
I did not know that. Yeah. So the beet farm was from...
Yes. And then the glasses, which, by the way... I really do think that Dwight has influenced popular culture because now all the hipsters wear the Dwight glasses.
You were the first hipster.
Yeah, I really was. I was like the hipster nerd who took those glasses and now everyone who goes to Intelligentsia Coffee and Silver Lake or Brooklyn are wearing those same glasses.
Right.
Yeah. Free commercial for Intelligentsia Coffee. Thank you. I'll take my gift card, please.
Was there anything for you as a theater actor like myself? It's a loaded question. Was there anything physically, any physical manifestation of Dwight within Rain?
That's a great question. And yes, there was. And I've never really talked about this before, but I went to theater school. I was an NYU grad program, did a lot of like clowning and did a lot of physical work and physical theater. You were involved in physical theater in Minneapolis. And I'm not trying to sound pretentious at all, like, oh, Mr. Theater, but... when you get that kind of training, a lot of it is physical. Like, how do you find a character in your body? You know, that's part of clown work as well. But there were certain elements of Dwight that if I needed to kind of get into character, I could just put my attention, put my focus in certain parts of my body, and I would immediately be Dwight. Like, a really, like, a straight neck, you know, and kind of hips forward and kind of thinking about, like, big hips. Like, I don't know if you notice that Dwight always stands too close to people. If someone's sitting down and he's standing next to him, like his hips are like really like big next to their face, kind of. And there's kind of a ramrod neck, a little bit of a swagger and the shoulders thrown back. Those were some of the elements of Dwight that if I was ever feeling like, do I really have him early on, you know, after you do two seasons, you can just do the character in your sleep. But early on, there were some of those physical choices that really were like clown kind of choices that I could go to just help me get into the world.
Right.
What about you for Kevin? Did you have some for Kevin?
Two. I mean, two that I can articulate. I'm sure there were more. For me, it was my jaw. I knew there was a specific place that I could put my jaw that was him. And also, I imagined him.
For the jaw thing, you had a weird mouth. You would make like a little mouth like this. So it's like a little,
just a little, yeah,
jutting it forward a little bit, and your lips would be a little, little like pursed.
Yeah, exactly. And also, I had the ideas as he moved through the space, there were two things. One is he wasn't aware of his size within the space, right? Which to me was always hilarious when I would come against Angela, right? Because I just wouldn't see her there and knock her around. And the other was that there was something about my torso that it doesn't move agilely from side to side. It's all sort of just all connected.
Yeah. Yeah.
Down at my hips, and that there's, yeah, those are the
two. Oh, yeah, yeah. So the whole body turns at the same
time.
You're
body
not able
turns
to like swivel
time.
Easily.
It's no, like, and maybe even shuffle my feet to turn to one direction
that's great.
If I need
that's
to.
That's great.
Hold on. 1 second.
That is not urine. That is water.
Speak for yourself. Why do people love Dwight?
Well, we talked earlier about the specificity of Dwight, and I think that how his glasses are and how his beeper is and the certain colors that he wears and the car he drives and how he sees the world. But, you know, the thing I hate the most about comedy, and I have been known to tiptoe into this land, but the thing I hate the most about it is when someone knows that they're being funny. And that's one of the, I think, keys to the comedy of The Office is that none of the characters thought of themselves as being funny. I think the documentary element helped with that tremendously. And I tried to play Dwight as outrageously as possible and as grounded and realistic as possible at the same time. So look at any scene and what's happening, as no matter how ridiculous it is, you can always tell there's a child, there's a big kid in there.
Yeah.
He could do just preposterous things. But I always tried to motivate them internally with some internal drive. Like, this is how Dwight saw the world. This is how you always knew how Dwight felt. I would guess that would be my number one answer is like, you can always tell what Dwight is feeling and what he's going through on the inside. And he thinks he's hiding. You know, people think, oh, is he, you know, is he on the spectrum? Does he have autism or something like that? But his heart is on his sleeve. You can always see what he's feeling, you know, is even if he's being haughty or even if he's being arrogant, like you always see what's going on the inside. And I think that that allowed people to relate to him. So in those moments when Dwight was sad or hurt or put off or disappointed, like people really felt for him.
What were your initial thoughts of the pilot when you first saw it? Were you proud of it?
I thought the pilot, I think if you look at all of our episodes, the pilot's one of the weakest, I think. It feels a little labored. It's not as funny as when we find our own voice in a few episodes, the healthcare and basketball episodes, a few ones later on. I liked it a lot, but because I knew the British Office so well, I just felt like, ooh, this is feeling a little bit like a paler imitation of the British Office. I wasn't the hugest fan, but at the same time, I really knew the potential of the show that we had.
Right. So going back and watching some of the stuff.
I want to say too, and this story has been told before, but the first season, for you listeners out there who don't understand this, like, we did 6 episodes. That's never done. No one does 6 episodes of a first season, especially back in those days of network television. Network television only makes money when they hit syndications. They have to have over 100 episodes, and they want to shoot as many as possible. So it was really weird that they, like, found some money in the budget to kind of shoot 6 under the radar episodes of The Office. But I mean, we barely hung on for the first year and a half. And then we were, a moderate hit for a while. And then we were kind of fading. You're so fired, whoever that was.
Fired.
So fucking
good
fired.
Lord. You were right. You were, God.
I hit you with my 5 pounds of mixed nuts. So who would have ever thunk that 15 years after shooting the pilot, this is when we're having this conversation, The Office would be bigger than ever, 200 episodes, defining roles for for all of us.
Do you remember after we shot the first 6 episodes of season 2, you and Steve and I were sitting in Steve's trailer, and Steve said, well, at least we got to do 12.
Mm.
And we thought we were done.
Yeah. And wasn't the next order for like
4?
2. Yeah. And then there was 4 and then like 1. Like, hey, we're doing 4. Hey, they ordered 1 more. Like, it's like, it just like, just dribs and drabs. And this is just not done in that world of network television.
Exactly. Yes. What I remember is 6, 4, 2, 1, 7. And then they said, okay, you can do 22. And then a week later, we got a 3rd season.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And it was like, oh, we're rolling.
Yeah, we're off to the races. And NBC hung that big bulletin board up. No, excuse me. What's it called? A billboard over by its offices with The Office on it. Like from out of nowhere, all of a sudden we were like their prized new show. And we were going from like almost canceled to, because the numbers just started to shoot up dramatically and the interest in the show started to shoot up dramatically.
Why? I mean, there was 40-year-old virgin.
Yes, that certainly contributed to it.
My Name is Earl.
We followed My Name is Earl, which had much stronger numbers right out of the gate and really helped us. And I talk about this in my book, but what happened around that Christmas time was that the first video iPods came out and they were preloaded with the Office Christmas episode on it. So basically all of the, you talk about like influencers, like I view it as like, who got video iPods for Christmas the first year they came out? The rich kids. So all the rich kids around America all of a sudden had an Office episode, and it was young people with their iPods who knew how to set up an iTunes account because their parents didn't. And that was the amazing thing. And I think that blindsided everybody, including NBC, that we would be so popular with young people.
Right. iTunes, the video iPod, technology. I mean, the show, were you on MySpace? Were you one of those?
Very briefly, like for like 2.5 months.
Yeah. Okay. Because that was Jenna and myself and Angela and BJ really used MySpace in that first season and a half when we were trying to cultivate viewers.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. So we were the kind of the first show that went hand in hand with technology and social media.
Yes. And then you became kind of king of Twitter.
That was later, but yeah, 2009, early on in Twitter, I joined early because I was founding the company Soul Pancake and they kind of insisted that I do it. And young people, young nerdy people that were starting out on Twitter and comedy people, I was like the big cheese for the first like 9 months of Twitter. There were hardly any bigger celebrities than me. So I immediately like had a million followers on Twitter early on.
Yeah. So the cold opens, the show kind of started finding itself and also finding its form.
Yep.
Right. Like having the cold opens that were separate from, the regular episodes. Right. What do you feel like those allowed us to do?
Well, I think they discovered early on, Greg is one of the people I've worked with the most who has this ability to ride this line of like real instinct. Like he'll just throw something out, like try this. I think that'll be really funny. And it's weird and it's out there and it's not related to anything, but also like really almost Spock-like precision about like what works about characters and what works about storylines. And one of the things they realized early on is that like, you know, Jim pranking Dwight, which the British show started obviously, but audiences loved that. So that was a really great way to have cold opens. They weren't all pranks, but a lot of them were pranks and the audience just loved them. I still, to this day, people are like, what's your favorite prank? When he did this prank, when he did that prank, do you guys prank each other? I always get that, like, do you prank each other backstage? It's like, no, we don't. It takes too much work and effort to prank someone. You have to plan it and think it through. We were just there shooting a TV show. Like, what am I going to?
Totally. You know, the only thing that I could think was, and it happened like 8 times. I remember there was a period, probably when the computer started working, where we could send IMs to each other. So it would be like, what are you doing? Like, while someone was doing a scene. Like, that's kind of the only thing I could think.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
Yeah, but so I think the cold opens really helped hook an audience in. Remember, this is not streaming. You're going to have a commercial between My Name is Earl and The Office is going to start. You got to hook them. You got that 90 seconds, 2 minutes. You want them to sit through the commercials that come right after that and stick with the show. So I think Greg was really canny about that too. Kind of like, we got to hook them in. And those things became swiftly kind of one of the strongest aspects of the show.
Well, and one of the other things that happened, which was a purely business decision, right? I don't know if you remember this. This was when the DVR, you would set the DVR to record from 9 to 9:30, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then we started showing up at 8:59. So if you had not set it to start earlier, right, you would miss it. So you would need to tune in earlier, which means if you were watching another channel, you'd have to turn over to NBC before 9 o'clock, and that changed the whole ratings things and then the supersized episodes and all of those things.
I, you know, speaking of the length of the episodes, we did a lot of episodes that were double episodes, and we did a lot of episodes that were just longer episodes.
Yes.
But I always felt, and I wonder if Greg would do this at some point in time. I don't know if there's some vault that has all of the Office material. Is that the first, not the first cut, but the rough cut that would get passed around for like notes that was too long, the 24, 25, 26 minute cuts of episodes were always way better. And I wonder if they'll ever be, in fact, I think that would be a really smart money-making scheme, is to re-release kind of director's cuts of all the episodes and let them be 24 to 29 minutes long. But it was always just such a pain to like cut them down from like that 25 minute sweet spot to that 21 minute 40 second mark that they would have to be to air with the commercials.
Yeah. Was there any story or anything that got cut out that you specifically remember regretting? I have one that I yelled at the editors about.
I think there was a lot more with me and Ellie doing Dothraki early on for Game of Thrones. That was they cut that almost down to almost nothing. And I remember being pissed. I was like, that was so funny. And they're like, we got to lose stuff. Sorry, we got to cut stuff. And because it was like the C story. So they're always going to cut the C story. The A story is always going to be like Michael and Jan and something. And the B story is like Dwight and Jim battling. And then the C story is going to be like some smaller thing. And sometimes Dwight is in the A story, but a lot of times he's in the C story. And that's always the one that gets kind of cut to the bone.
Right.
What was your one?
Mine was baby shower, and Jan is having the baby. And Kevin asks her where she got her sperm donated from. And Jan says it's a very, very exclusive place. You wouldn't know it. And Kevin says the one behind the IHOP. And the look on Steve's face and her face and the idea that Jan's baby might have been Kevin's.
Oh!
Was just pure comedy.
Oh, that's hysterical.
Just so fun. And they were like, yeah, we're not doing anything with that. Or like, what if that? And I was like, oh my God, that's just so funny.
That's funny.
All right, we're going to stop there for now. I'm so sorry. We have to stop right in the middle. That's what he said, I guess. Don't freak out, because you are going to hear even more from Rain in a future episode. But I had to leave you with that thought. The idea that Kevin may have been the father of Jan's baby. In fact, I'm quite convinced that he was, that Kevin was the father of Astrid, and he would have loved the name and giggled at it. So think about that before we're back. Anyway, thank you for listening. You guys are the best. I am so excited to have you with me on this journey, and we'll see you next week for another episode of The Office Deep Dive. The Office Deep Dive is hosted and executive produced by me, Brian Baumgartner, alongside our executive producer, Ling Lee. Our senior producer is Tessa Kramer. Our associate producer is Emily Carr. And our assistant editor is Diego Tapia. My main man in the booth is Alec Moore. Our theme song, Bubble and Squeak, performed by my great friend, Creed Bratton, and the episode is mixed by Seth Olansky. Special thanks to the amazing production crew who recorded these interviews with us: Joanna Sokolowski, Julia Smith, Benny Spiewak, Russell Wijaya, Margaret Borchert, Christian Bonaventura, Matthew Rosenfield, Alex Mobison, Lucy Savage, Judson Pickward, Jack Walden, Jonathan Mayer, Andrew Stephen, David Lincoln, and Saida Lee.